Okay, good afternoon. So someone asked me to go over some of the quiz questions before beginning a class, and I think that sounds like a fine idea. So what questions are people most interested in knowing about from our quiz for this week? Yes? If you mean this one, that was a keying mistake. But yeah, I wrote the answer with 32 in mind, 32 bits instead of 64. But the question clearly said 64. Any other questions? Things people are interested in going over here? Yes.
I don't know the exact question, but it was like something about how to increase the hash size. If you go down, I can recommend.
So, these questions?
Yeah, those questions.
Okay. So, this was asking, so, if we make these changes, which of these will increase the hit rate of the cache? So what is the hit rate? Does someone have a definition of hit rate in their head? Yes?
The ratio of attempts to get something from cache versus the amount of times cache actually had it.
Yeah, so it's how often, when we go to the cache, is something there. So increasing the cache size means we can store more things in the cache. So more often when we go and look for something, we'll still have a copy. We won't have thrown it away because of something else. And decreasing it won't do that. Increasing the block size means that more often we'll look for something in the cache and we'll have a copy of it because we fetched it earlier for another thing in the block, because the block contains multiple values that we might read from the cache. And increasing the associativity for a typical program with locality is going to mean that more often we'll still have a copy of something, whereas with less associativity, we might have had to throw it away because there was a coincidence that two things mapped to the same set. That those coincidences are less likely to happen with more associativity. Yes?
Do C and E, are they changed by locality, spatial or temporal locality?
Absolutely. So this is a question which is asking whether it's likely, because we're making an assumption about our programs. We'll get into that a little later today. So we also had a part which asked similar question which asked about the miss penalty. So the miss penalty is, if we don't find something in the cache, how much time do we take afterwards to get it, give it back to the CPU, and put it in our cache? And increasing the block size is going to increase the miss penalty, because we're going to need to fetch something from memory, and how much we have to fetch depends on the block size. And increasing the associativity is likely to increase the miss penalty, because we need to figure out which block to replace, and we need to access that block, and having a more associativity means that that's going to be more complicated. So any other quiz questions people were curious about? Any of these calculations you think we should go over? Yeah. Number two. So this is asking you to compute the cache size. And remember from last time, cache size doesn't include overhead. It's the amount of data we can store. And this is the number of sets times the number of blocks in each set times how big each block is. So here, we're given the size of each block, so we have that. And we're not given the number of sets, but we are given the number of blocks in each set because it's direct mapped. Direct map means there's one block for each set. So we somehow have to go from this 20 tad bits and see if we can figure out the number of sets. And if you remember, we have a relationship between tag bits and all the other types of bits in our address, that we split up this 32-bit address into 20 tag bits, some number of index bits, and some number of offset bits. So we can't figure out the number of index bits yet, but the number of offset bits, all we need to know is the block size. And the block size here is 64 bytes, which means that there are 6 offset bits. So that means there are 20 tag bits plus 6 offset bits, and the whole address is 32 bits, so the remaining bits must be the set index bits. And from that number of bits, we can get the number of sets. And once we have the number of sets, that will we can multiply by the 64-byte block size, and that will give us our cache size. Yes? Number 5. So this is asking which of these changes can decrease conflict misses in the cache. So a conflict miss is a case where if we gave values different addresses but accessed them in the same pattern, we could fit it in the cache. We just had something unlucky happen where there was a coincidence and things mapped to the same set of the cache. So one option here is doubling the number of lines per set. That's increasing the associativity and having the number of sets. This means that for every value, you have more places to put it. So even though two things are likely to end up in the same set, we strictly have more options on where to put something. We previously had two things which could, two values would map to one set and have two places. Now, they'll map to, still map to the same set, because having the number set doesn't change, you know, those coincidences, but they'll have four places to go. So we're going to make things better, at least. We're not going to make them worse by making this change. So the other correct answer was doubling the number of sets and having the block size. This means that a particular value has less likelihood of conflicting, because if we access two different parts of a block that happen to map to the same set, they might have conflicted before and might not conflict anymore. So it could make things better, and at worst, we're in the same situation where the two things map to the same part of the block and therefore the same set still. Was there confusion on any of the distractor answers? Yeah.
If you double the block size and double the size, it's possible you can decrease it even though it's not likely. If you can decrease the number of conflict misses, if your program has spatial locality, so you can, instead of just accessing like X words, you can access 2X words if you...
So those are not conflict misses, is the issue.
You're thrashing the cache, and then, so... I mean, it's not likely, but it can't.
So the issue is that what you're talking about, what we get from the higher block size, the misses we're avoiding are not conflict misses. I guess you're saying that they could be conflicts. There could be conflicts and accessing things in the same block. Okay,
Right, like if we had a 4K cache, we access after 0, 4K, 0.
That's the straight, yeah.
Then if we change it to an 8K cache, we no longer have a conflict.
Yeah, that's okay. Sorry. Can we just not count that answer at all?
Probably.
Okay.
I'll find a way to do
that. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, so it would be less likely, but yes, you're right. Thank you. Any other inquiries? Questions? And and apparently I wasn't recording video, which is great. So let's move on to our topic for today, which is on that screen, which is to continue talking about how caches work. So last time we left off looking at how we dealt with writes. And we had several choices we had to make with writes that didn't come up with reads. So one of those was whether we always sent a write to memory or whether we kept it around in our cache and only sent it later. And that choice meant that we had to keep around this dirty bit to know whether or not we need to send something to memory before we get rid of it. And we also had our replacement policy choice with writes, where we needed to know, with reads, where we needed to keep track of another extra bit in order to know what are we actually going to replace in the cache. So there's another choice we need to make on writes besides whether or not we send something to memory. And that's about what we do if we write something and we don't have a copy of it. So if we write something and we already have it in our cache, we definitely do want to modify what we have in our cache because it would be really weird if you wrote something and didn't read it back. But if we don't have a copy, we have a choice. We could put it in our cache. This is called write allocate, which means we fetch the block that contains the thing that's being written. So if the processor isn't writing the whole block at once, which is usually the case, that means we need to read from memory, even though this is a write, and we replace the written part. And assuming we're doing write back, we mark it as dirty. Alternately, there's a write no allocate policy, where we say, if I don't already have a copy of it, I'm not going to spend time reading it from memory. I'm just going to send it through and not worry about it. And real caches have made both of these choices. So the advantage of write allocate is that, you know, if we're writing something, we're probably reading something nearby soon. So it's generally good if programs have good locality. Especially if you have a write back policy where, you know, this is saving you from doing a write to memory anyways. But it's more complicated, and it means writes are slower if you, you know, don't use a value very soon. So with write allocate and dirty bits, you can run into a situation where if we're writing a value and we decide to replace this dirty least recently used block, that we need to, first of all, write this old block, not the one we're writing, to memory, so we can get rid of it and put a new block in its place. Then read in the new block to get the thing next to what we're writing, replace what we're writing, and also update the LRU information. So we're doing two memory operations and also changing a bunch of other bits in the cache besides the data in order to read in this new value, write this value, which means reading in the block for it. So, questions on this procedure? So if we didn't choose to do write allocate, this is a lot simpler, which is the attraction of not doing write allocate, even though it's good for locality. That, you know, we just send it to memory, and we avoid any case where we do two memory operations for one request from the processor. So one thing you might assume is that when we have to talk to memory, that's going to mean we're doing a lot of waiting, especially if we have to read and write to memory. Caches have this trick where they make writes actually substantially faster as far as the processor is concerned than reads. And this is something called a write buffer. So rather than actually waiting to write for a value to get to memory and be finished writing, caches typically have a small little mini cache of values that are waiting to be written. And this gives them a place to put a value while it's being written so they can replace the part of the cache immediately. So if the line is dirty, they can put it in its write buffer when they evict it from the cache, and as long as they still have space in the write buffer for the time it takes the write to go to memory, they don't have to slow down the rest of the cache read. So that replacement can start immediately, and in the background, the cache will finish the write. So it will hold this in this write buffer, and the write buffer will send it to memory, even though that's probably slower than modifying the cache itself. And this same technique means that write through is not actually that bad. So write through caches are not inefficient because they have these write buffers, so the writes happen in the background. You start a write and it happens eventually. So as long as you aren't writing too much for the memory to handle, you're not going to notice an actual slowdown even from a write through cache, besides that you won't get the extra hits from reading the thing you wrote. So, questions about these write policies? Yes?
So if the block that's being written to is already in the cache, will it still write through, or will it just write it to the
cache? So if it has a write through policy, yes. If it has a write back policy, no. And this is a choice the cache designer made.
So if it's write through, it would write all the way through, but also update the cache, right?
Yes, because if you read that value later, you better read what you wrote. You'd be very confused if seed worked that way. Okay, so let's move on to the main topic, which is going to be how caches actually affect program performance. And we'll start out with a simple example of a program that sums up the values in a matrix. I'm going to, for now, represent this as a two-dimensional array in C. And here we access 0, 0, 0, 1, and so on to compute our sum. So let's think about how this actually ends up looking with our cache. So first of all, what do we need to know how this is going to behave in our cache? Yes?
2D arrays are actually just a really long 1D array.
Yeah, so we need to know how does this array actually look in memory. So that's really important to know because we need to know what memory addresses are we giving the cache. And the typical layout is that if I'm drawing across each line 4 bytes of memory, and then the following 4 bytes in the next line, is it's going to look like this. So that we have 0, 0, followed immediately at the next memory address by 0, 1, then 0, 2, and so on until we get to the end of the first row or column, depending on how you view things, and then 1, 0, and so on. So given that layout, What else do we need to know in order to figure out how this is going to perform with the cache? Yes?
Aren't the elements stored in row major order?
It depends what you call. So if you're calling the first thing a row, yes. The rows are stored together. So if you call the first index the row number, if you call I, yes. So, I'm going to try to avoid referring to rows and columns too much to avoid the confusion about which we write first. Just say 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. So we know that it's laid out like this, and we know we're accessing this first, then this, then this. I'm giving the loop iteration numbers here. What else do we need to know how much of the time we have misses or hits in the cache? Yeah.
How many blocks there are?
So we need to know about the cache blocks. We need to know how those blocks actually map to these memory locations. What values are in the same block? And also, we need to know how many blocks fit in the cache. You have
block size.
So the block size. So block size is probably the most important part. And let's say, for our example, we have an 8-byte cache block. That's a relatively small size, but this is a small example that I want to fit on slides. So with an 8-byte cache block, that means 00 and 01 are in the same cache block. And given this access pattern, that's enough to figure out that if we start from the cache not having anything, what's a hit and a miss? So our first access, if the cache starts empty, has to be a miss. But our next access is to the same block, so it's a hit. And this repeats. So we get 50% hits. So this is an example of spatial locality. We're accessing things which are at similar memory addresses. They're consecutive in memory. And because of the cache blocks, we're getting an advantage from that. So this is why we generally say that, you know, larger cache blocks can be good, because they let us exploit spatial locality. And this is why we want our cache blocks to be larger than our individual values we access. Even though that means, for example, if we're doing write back, or we have to write allocate rather, we have to read in a value from memory in order to fill the rest of the cache block. But if we made our blocks infinitely large, we'd run into trouble. So what's the problem with making our cache blocks really, really big? Now, how could we end up with worse performance for not this program, but for some other program with good spatial locality? So one way to think about this is, let's think about the most degenerate case. What's the largest we could make a cache block? Well, we could have the whole cache be one block. So if our whole cache is one block, like one 32 kilobyte block, then if we get unlucky and want to access, say, two arrays and access them sequentially, we're gonna be thrashing. So clearly, at the limit, larger block sizes hurt us. And the reason they hurt us is even though they are better at helping us with spatial locality, they're worse at helping us with temporal locality. Having larger blocks means we have to evict more every time we replace something. And that means that we're less good at having what we accessed recently. But in exchange for that, we're better at having what we accessed nearby. So this is how we can think about how block size is going to affect our performance from the standpoint of how often do we hit or miss. So there's another type of thing we talk about with misses besides whether or not they're in the same block, which was from conflicts. And a common way that conflicts come up is when you have not great spatial locality. And it's not because your spatial locality is especially inherently bad, but it's because you have coincidences happen. And we're going to illustrate that with this case. So let's just swap these two loops. So I'm doing essentially the same number of instructions by just swapping these two loops. And I'm just accessing the values in a different order. I'm going 00, 10, 20, 01. So if we look at how that turns out on our view of memory, we have our matrix laid out, and we're accessing 00, then 10. So you have worse spatial locality. So how much worse could our miss rate be? Yeah.
That everything misses.
So everything could miss. So what's one way everything could miss?
If the block size is small enough that, you know, if we go 0, 0 first, 1, 0, if those aren't in the same block, then it's going to miss. And then we go back and forth, and we're just going to miss every time.
Okay. So first of all, if we don't have a big enough block size that both 0, 0 and 1, 0 are in the same block, the second access is going to be a miss. So how about when we get around on the iteration number 4 to access 0, 1 again? If we have the same block size as before, is that going to be a hit or a miss, most likely? Or how do we routine up? So, what's going to, yeah?
If you have a block that's too small, then it's probably going to take the stuff in the first row, I guess. Or it's going to have the stuff from 1, 0 on in the block rather than stuff in 0, so it's going to be a miss.
Okay, so your concern is that if our cache can't hold everything in this matrix, maybe after we go access 0, 1, 2, and 3, maybe that's all that's going to fit. I mean, we'll run out of space in our cache. So that would mean, in this case, that we only have room in our cache. So if this access here is a miss, that if we ran out of space, that would mean that we've done access 3 other things, and we needed to evict it. So that would mean our cache has 2 blocks. So could we still have this problem if our cache is bigger than that? If we have, say, 4 blocks in our cache? So what would we need to know to figure out whether this was a miss or not? To figure out what's happening with the cache, if we know the cache size and the block size. What information are we missing? So we had some choices that were made here. So what's a choice that we made for this cache that isn't a block size or the cache size? One. Yeah. So how many sets to have? So a choice we made about the cache organization of the cache. So we need to know how many things are in each set. So if we look back at this pattern with bad spatial locality, how could that manifest here? How could the number of things we have in a set change whether or not this access to 0, 1 ends up being a hit or a miss? Yeah?
They're the same index.
So if they happen to have the same index, then there's a possibility. If 2 things have the same index, there's a possibility they'll interfere. So if we look here, we have a case where we're replacing something in index 0, even though there's still an empty spot in the cache. And that's exactly what a conflict miss is. So we might run into a case where maybe the cache has space for enough stuff, but what we access in iteration 0 and iteration 1 and iteration 2 and iteration 3 end up not being able to use all 4 of those spaces. They map to less than 4 sets, so there's a conflict, so we run out of space in our cache. And a way this could happen is, you know, let's say we even have 8 sets, then this maps to set 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we wrap around to 8 when we got to 2, 0. But if we only have 8 sets, that means this is going to be set index 0. Because we go to 7, then 0. So if our cache is direct mapped, this would mean that these two things can't be in the cache at the same time, that 00 and 20 can't be in the cache at the same time. So in iteration 3, we might access 20, let's say, and then that will make it so iteration 4, which reads 01, will be a miss. And this is even though our cache might have space for enough values. We have 8 blocks of space in this cache, but we're only using set 0 and set 4. And what was the problem with our matrix which made this happen? Why do we have 00 and 20 mapping to the same sets? So what could we change about our matrix, which would, you know, about this problem, which would make that not happen? Yeah.
Increase or decrease the array size.
Yeah. So if we chose any number other than 4 and 8, pretty much any, you know, thing which didn't look like that, we chose 3, or we chose 5 for then the first index, and, you know, 7 or 9 possibilities for the second, we probably wouldn't run into this problem. But the problem is we chose something that's a power of 2. And when we write a power of 2 out in binary, we get something that ends with a lot of zeros. When you add that to an address, you don't change the lower bits. And the lower bits have our block offset and our set index. So that means when we have powers of 2 sizes, we don't change our index very much when we go by an increment of that size. So this is a reason that you can accidentally have conflicts in the cache, even though you aren't accessing that much stuff, and you don't have a particularly malicious pattern as far as how you're trying to look at things. And this sort of problem, and that this can come up so coincidentally just because we happen to use a power of 2 for something, which we might happen to do a lot of the time, is a reason why caches want to add associativity. Because these sorts of programs are common, where sometimes you'll have an array which has a size which is a power of 2 or almost a power of 2, and you'll access, or an array of something which is that, and you'll access consecutive things, and these will create conflicts in the cache. And it's really hard to have programmers just avoid that consistently. So more associativity is a good solution to this. Now, we could have avoided the conflicts if we chose a different size, and you might have a question of, like, how common is this really? And it's not clear. Like, you can't just look at the instruction set and say, how often are people accessing things where the lower order bits in the address vary? You need to know what programs look like. So people who actually wanted to answer this question about how much do I need to worry about people writing programs where they access things from the same cache sets over and over again, took real programs and ran them in a simulator. So what you can do is we know how to go through in our slides, whether something is a cache miss, what block you set in the cache, what the dirty bit is and the LRU settings and all that. We know how to do that by hand. And if you know how to do it by hand, you could write a computer program to do that. So people have done this. They've written a computer program which does all those cache operations and keeps track of what all the state is everywhere. And they attach it to a processor simulator, kind of like the one you're writing now, in order to get all the memory accesses for a real program. And then they run real benchmarks that someone cared about, at least in 2000, on it, and see what happens. And here are some measurements from the SPEC 2000 benchmarks for various types of caches. So they're using a 64-byte block size, and they're varying the associativity. and the cache size. So there ran a whole lot of possibilities. Spent days of CPU time to do these simulations. And from this, you can see what the benefit of associativity is. And one notable thing is that there is a substantial benefit to having at least two ways of associativity, at least having two choices about where to place a block, being able to deal with one coincidence in the set of bits. Now, on these real programs, and programs in general, when we look at them, that first way of associativity helps a whole lot. From then on, you get diminishing returns. So going up all the way from 2 to 8 does give us some improvement, but it's like 0.6% versus more than 1% improvement in miss rate. And going from 8-way to fully associative gives you almost nothing, even though a fully associative cache is way, way, way more complicated hardware than an 8-way one. So another thing you can see here is that these programs sort of have a maximum cache size they can really use. That once we get above 64 kilobytes, we don't get that much more benefit from the cache. And this is typical of real programs. The way you can think about it is that at any given time, there's a certain amount of stuff a program is using. And if you could fit all that stuff in the cache, you don't need any more cache. There's no reason to have a larger cache. And the sizes are going to depend on the program. So what would you do if I told you to write a program with 100% miss rate on some size of cache, on say, even on 100 megabyte cache? How could you do that? Yeah. Yeah, so one thing we could do is we could try to repeat access all of an 100 megabyte object over and over again. The cache can't possibly store the entire 100 more than 100 megabyte object. 100 megabyte cache can't store the whole thing, so we would expect lots of misses, especially if the cache does something like LRU, where it takes the last thing we accessed and replaces it. And then we access it right again because we just access it sequentially. So you can always construct programs which look bad for this, but this is what typical programs have some amount of data they're using, and it's often not that large. But it depends on the program. We can construct programs which are larger, and you might have real reasons your program needs more data, just because that's what it's working with. And whether a cache is useful to you is going to depend on that. So with the idea that caches depend on what program we're writing, let's think about whether LRU, this replacement policy, which we've said is what we really want to do, is always better. And a thing to remember is that the reason we're using LRU is because it exploits temporal locality. It's that we assume our programs will access things sooner, and therefore LRU will look good. How could we make a program which makes LRU look bad? What would that program look like? Yes?
I suppose if you loop through a long array forwards and then backwards.
So if we just go through an array sequentially, for example.
I guess if you just went through it two times forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Sequentially, like that, then the thing we're accessing each time, if we loop through it, is something we haven't accessed in a very long time, every time. We don't have this property that what we access is something we recently accessed. So scans like that are exactly the worst case for LRU. The reason we use LRU is because we know that measuring real programs, they don't look like that. If that was the case, we'd expect this fully associative column to actually have worse miss rates. And from this sort of principle, we can figure out how to make LRU or any sort of cache organization look bad. So here's an example of an access pattern where I have a two-set direct map cache and a fully associative two-way cache. And I've chosen an access pattern where the fully associative cache just does worse. And the way I did this is I said, looked here, I said, oh, this has 0.3, this has 3.1, I should just access 0. Now, I can just always choose to access something that I know won't be in the cache given how it operates. The cache can't look ahead at what I'm going to do. So there's always this possibility of making a program which makes any sort of cache look bad. And there's a general way of doing this for any cache, not just for that specific example, which is if you want to make a cache look bad, you just keep track of what it has. And you produce an access pattern which first you fill up every entry of the cache and then replace something. And then you just keep accessing the thing you just replaced over and over again. And if you knew what the cache just replaced, you could do this. And this is going to make the cache have 100% miss rate. And it's also pretty much guaranteed that if you have a cache which is one step larger or has more associativity, or you change any of the parameters that and you use the same access pattern, it's likely to do better because it's not just replacing what was just replaced, not just accessing what was just replaced. So the question is not about what might happen, it's about what typical programs do. So when we talk about cache performance, we're not going to be thinking about what could happen generally. We're going to be thinking about, given the properties we know programs have, what's going to be better? And one of the properties we know programs have is locality. So when we think about whether a cache is going to be more efficient than another cache, we're going to think about programs with locality and how that's going to perform in that cache. So both spatial locality and temporal locality. And we're typically going to assume that there's some conflicts in the low order bits so that we're going to have some spurious cases where some naive strategy where we only have one place to put a block, the direct map or very low associativities, might get us in a little bit of trouble. And these are not things which have to be true about all programs, but they're things where people have measured programs in simulators to get those results like I showed earlier, and they are true most of the time. So with that in mind, we can look at what are changes in cache parameters, which was one of the quiz questions, and how they affect our cache performance. And when we talk about cache performance, we're usually going to be thinking about three quantities. So one is hit time. How long does it take to get something out of the cache if it's there? Another is the miss penalty. How long does it take to get something into the cache if it wasn't there originally? And the third one, the one we've been spending most of our effort on, and the one that you as a programmer have the most control over, is miss rate, which is how often is something actually in the cache. And we have trade-offs for pretty much all of these. Increasing the cache size will decrease the miss rate. We can put more on our cache. But it's going to make the hit time worse, because a bigger cache is going to take up more space, it's going to take signals longer to travel, it's going to be slower. This is why we don't just have megabyte cache, L1 caches everywhere. We can increase the associativity, and that generally, for real programs, will decrease the miss rate. But it will make the hit time worse because we have to check more tags, and we have to have a mux to select which block to get, and that takes time. It's also likely to make our miss penalty worse because we have a more complicated decision to make about where to store the block we get from memory. We can increase the block size, and that has this trade-off. A really large block size means we can't take advantage of temporal locality. A really small one means we can't take advantage of spatial locality. And generally, increasing the block size is also going to make hits take longer because we have to get a larger value out and select the bits we want, the bytes we want, and means going to memory is going to take longer. So the miss penalty is higher. So one thing we haven't talked much about is secondary caches. So on my laptop from Exercise Tuesday, we had an L1, an L2, and L3 cache. And the L2 cache is where the L1 cache goes instead of memory. And the idea of having an L2 cache from the perspective of the L1 cache is that it improves the miss penalty. So these are the sorts of things we can do to make misses less bad. And it's an easy way to improve the miss penalty, which might give you a lot more benefit for the sort of total time that you have versus one of these cache size changes. Similarly, our various write policies and our replacement policies also are going to be things where they'll improve the miss rate by having a smarter replacement policy or a write policy that's more likely to keep things in the cache, but are going to hurt how long it takes to move data, extra data, to and from memory, and to make more complicated decisions when we're replacing a block. So any questions about any of these sort of cache changes and their effects? Yes?
Can you just talk one more time how write allocate affects miss rate and miss penalty?
So write allocate means that when we write something, we bring in the things around it into the cache. So if we read that thing or things around it later on, which is likely because we assume our programs have temporal and spatial locality, and those would both be examples of that, then it's going to be a hit when without write allocate, it might not be. So that's why it improves the miss rate. It hurts the miss penalty because we're bringing in something on a write rather than just sending it to memory. And that's a write miss, because we still have to look something up in the cache when we do a write. Okay, so this is about what hardware designers can do to make caches faster. There's also a bunch of things that you as programmers can do. And we're going to talk about those. As a diversion, I'm going to use code where we're dealing with matrices, and I'm going to use not two-dimensional arrays like you saw earlier, but I'm going to use this sort of flat array. And the reason I'm doing this is because in code I write in C, I typically don't have a fixed size matrix. I need to choose the size at runtime. So I want an n by n matrix, and I want to malloc it, which means I need to get a flat piece of memory and use it as that. So what I'll do is I'll allocate an n by n and use I times n plus j to act instead of I j. This is just a way of naming all the elements. I'm also using this here because it's going to make it clearer what things are next to each other in memory than this does. Any questions on this? Yes?
So it's better to turn 2D array into a 1D array?
Well, I can't use, if n is a variable, I just can't use a 2D array in C. That's the main problem. But I'm also using it just because it's easier to see what's next to each other in memory from the flat from this flat version. Okay, so using this, I'm going to show an example of squaring a matrix. If you've had linear algebra of some sort, you've seen this. If you haven't, we're just taking Bij and summing up for all k, some a sub ik and a sub jk, which is exactly this thing here. And we're doing it for all I, all j, and all k. There's n of them, so we have a triply nested loop. And when I wrote this, I had a choice. Do I do I first or not? Do I do j first? I could do k first. And I made one set of choices. I could have also made some different choices. I could have done k, then I, then j, instead of I, then j, then k. And there's no particular reason that's obvious about which one to choose. But just like we saw with the matrix sum, where switching from rows to columns and columns to rows gave us a difference between every other access was a cache hit versus none of them were, this could have a big difference in performance. So, for example, one thing that's true about both of these is that this bij here in this inner loop is the same bij each time we change the k. So we're accessing bij repeatedly, so it has good temporal locality. And in version 2, the same thing is true about this aik. That it's the same, our inner loop uses j, so that doesn't change what this is in the inner loop, so we access this n times in this innermost loop. So it has good temporal locality. Yes?
And the formula at the top, is that supposed to be aik times a?
Yes, kj. Yes. Use the version in the code when in doubt. As always, the code is the documentation if there's a contradiction. I will fix this when I post the slides. Okay, so with this in mind, discuss with your neighbor which of these two versions you think is likely to be fastest. So I've told you about some temporal locality, but there's other kinds of locality which might be good. So you should try to look for those.
One value for each IJ.
So you're probably saying for the first one.
Okay, so who has who's come to a conclusion about either way about this? Okay, a couple people. So who thinks the first version is probably faster? Okay, some people. Who thinks the second version is probably faster? Okay, some defender of the first version want to explain your reasoning? There are good reasons to think they're both fast. Yeah?
Okay, I'm not entirely sure, but what I was thinking is that because in the first one, the J and K are, at least in two of the memory accesses, are the like closer together indices, whereas I and the first memory access. So I is being accessed like in farther apart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly the best way to explain it, but so like I is affecting the memory on a larger scale, whereas J and K are affecting it on a smaller scale. And so if J and K are changing more quickly, then they will have better spatial locality.
Yeah, so your thought is that hey, we have, when we change I, that's really bad for our spatial locality. So maybe it's good that we're not changing I as much in this version. And that's a reason you might think that this looks like a sort of better idea. So anyone want to give a reason why they thought version 2 was faster? Yes?
So my idea was that in the first version, in the innermost loop, you're incrementing k,
mm-hmm.
and because the second multiplicand is a to the k times n plus j, that memory access is going to jump by like a lot every time it iterates through that k. And so in the second version, the j, which is the innermost, is never multiplied by anything, and so that won't happen in the innermost loop. But it will probably still happen in the other loop, so I'm not sure.
So in the second version, you notice that there's good locality in AKJ, which just doesn't exist here. And if you were looking carefully, you'd also notice there's good locality in BIJ. So that would be a reason to think the second version is faster. So the question is, which of these is more important? And there's a way to tell, which is to actually run it. And it turns out the second version is faster. So here's the number of instructions for each of the two versions. The lines exactly coincide, so I know I'm running the actual, basically same code. And here's how long it takes in clock cycles. And at the bottom is the value of n. And yes, there are these little rises, and no, they aren't errors. And so it turns out that this spatial locality is pretty useful. Another way of looking at this, a common way we talk about the efficiency of code that uses caches, is to look at the ratio between the number of cycles run and the number of instructions. So the number of cycles per instruction. And for example, on your processor that you're implementing, that would ideally be 1. On my system, it's a superscalar processor, so it's less than 1. But we notice that when we're using our memory more efficiently, since memory is the big cause of slower instructions, that this value is lower than when we're using it inefficiently. So, yeah, the big summary as to why is there this difference is that in both cases, we have one thing with temporal locality. But because of this last J, both BIJ and AKJ have good spatial locality. They're both changing in J. That's what the order the memory is stored in. So we're both accessing consecutive memory locations in the innermost loop. Whereas with the alternate order, we're accessing K in the bottom. Only AIK are we accessing consecutive locations of. So it's not that we're completely lacking locality in any version. It's just that the locality in this version is a bit better. And that turns out to be like twice as good performance. So questions about this reasoning? So one question you might have if you looked at this data is, what are these? You know, and are those real? Where are they from? So we can take a look at some more precise data to try to break that down. So in addition to looking at the number of cycles things took and the number of instructions that were ran, I looked at the number of read misses in the L1 cache. This is the number for 1,000 instructions. And you can, so that's roughly the same for each program. And you can see that our good order has basically a constant number, and our bad order has these spikes and an increasing number from the difference in locality. And these spikes are pretty puzzling. Like, who has an idea, like, why did I measure all these spikes? What's going on in my system? Yeah?
Are you exceeding the size of like the L1 cache? Or the size of the block?
Size of the block in a cache? So we're doing that way down here. So the question isn't why it increases. Why do we have these spikes here? Like, do you think it makes sense for exceeding the size of the block that it would be slower for this point than the one next to it? No. Okay. Do you have any ideas about what might explain that going up and then down? Yes.
I'm guessing those are conflict misses followed by periods of spatial locality and another conflict miss.
Yeah. So the idea is these are conflict misses. These are cases where our n happens to be related to a power of 2. Now, this is pretty puzzling. So let's look at a zoom into the first part of the graph. So the first thing to note is that we have this region where it's essentially no cache misses. And the reason for that is that this is the point where our matrices fit in our L1 cache entirely. So we can just store the whole thing and we have essentially no cache misses up to that point. And after that, we start having to actually access memory. And we have these little outliers. And conflict misses is the right idea. So somehow we're getting that case where the set bit index bits become the same. Now you might say, why is that happening for this point here, which happens to be 93? What's special about 93? And it's probably pretty hard to think of any reason why 93 would do this, because it's not like 4 or 8 like we saw earlier, where it's pretty clear that that's going to, you know, skip ahead a certain number of sets, given that our caches have a power of 2 number of sets. But what happened here is that this 93, if you multiply it times 11, that is very, very close to 2 to the 10. And this 114 here, if you multiply it times 9, is very, very close to 2 to the 10. So that's what the reason for these spikes in non-obvious places. We also have some more obvious spikes, like this one at 2 to the 7. So skipping ahead 2 to the 7 elements is going to skip ahead 2 to the 9 bytes in the cache. So that's going to leave the bottom 9 bits of the address the same. So it's pretty clear that most of the set bits won't change if our set bits start before that. But for these, it's less obvious. You have to actually do the division to figure out, oh, that's kind of close to a power of 2 when we're looking at accessing the 0th thing, then the 11th thing in that column or row. So in particular, if we have ak times 93 plus j and ak plus 11 times 93 plus j, two things we're going to access in close proximity in this loop order, then these are 1,023 elements apart in their memory addresses, which on the system I tested this on is 63.9 cache blocks apart. So as long as this first thing is a little bit after the beginning of the cache block, then this second thing, 11 things further, is going to be mapping to the same set, because there are 64 sets in the cache. So we get this case, so we get these extra cache misses from that. So how could we as a programmer avoid this problem? Any solutions? So it seems pretty tricky. There are solutions, but it's not obvious because, you know, we know to avoid powers of two, perhaps, but avoiding 93 doesn't seem like advice you'd give anyone without really understanding what's going on. And maybe we'll get to answers later or after the exam. So I showed you L1 misses. There's also misses in the L2. These things go all the way to memory, including problems with conflicts. Happens in the other levels of the cache. And note that the scale here is much lower, that the maximum, the typical rate is like 0.01 for an instruction, not more than 2. But this is a big source of a performance problem, because the difference between something hitting in our L2 and not is, you know, like an order of magnitude. So this does matter, and you actually do need to care a bit about what's going to happen in the higher levels of cache. So we've seen one way of getting better performance out of a program that accessed a lot of memory. And we're going to look at a more systematic way of thinking about how do we access memory in a good way. And our goal every time is going to be to get the most work done every time we have a cache miss. And if we think about this loop order here, every time we have a cache miss for a BIJ, to load a BIJ, we're getting one computation out of that. There's spatial locality, so it's one computation for everything that shares the block, but it's one computation essentially. When we have a miss for AIK, we're getting N, because we do use load AIK once in this inner loop. And we use it every iteration of the loop, because J is what changes in loop and not I or K. And for AKJ, we change it in every iteration of the loop. So we essentially get one computation. So assuming that N is big enough that when we access BIJ, or sorry, AKJ, and then go to the next I, that it's not going to still be in cache, that we've accessed enough things that we've ran out of room in our cache, then we only get reuse from AIK. So effectively, the things that matter in our cache in this innermost loop when N is large is just AIK. Everything else being in our cache isn't really helping us. So this is really inefficient. So we're going to look at how we can do better than this. We're going to skip to here. So I'm going to use a trick that's first going to seem like I'm just doing nothing. So I'm going to replace our outermost loop with two loops. So I have one loop, which is using a double K, and another loop, which is using a single K, and I'm incrementing the double K by 2, incrementing the single K by 1, and limiting it to the double K plus 2. So this is the same thing as the original program, as far as what the values of K are in each iteration. So I'm computing the same thing. I've just split up one loop into two loops. And I'm ignoring the case where N isn't even, just to keep things simple. So this computes the same thing, I just added an extra loop. And the reason I did that is that we can apply the same thing we did before. Earlier, we moved loops around and saw how they improved locality. So let's try doing that now that we've added another loop. So I just moved it from here to the innermost loop. So let's think about what this ends up looking like if we expand the contents of the loop. This is going to help us understand what the locality looks like. So I've just working out both of the iterations of the loop, the body separately, rather than showing you the loop. So does this have better locality than we had before? Or worse locality? Yes.
But in the second line, you're jumping by n, right? Like for the a, kk plus 1 times n plus k.
Yes. So we have a little worse locality there. Are there any cases where you think anyone thinks we have better locality in this version? So why not take a look at Bij? If we look at the version before, you made this change. This was version 2. We accessed Bij once and then didn't access it again until another iteration of this outermost loop. If we look at what we have now, we're accessing Bij twice in the innermost loop. So we're getting reuse out of Bij, which we didn't get before, because we accessed everything else before we got back to it. So we actually have a little more temporal locality in Bij. We're also accessing Aik and Aik plus 1, two things that are next to each other in memory that we previously weren't doing because k was the outermost loop before. So we have better spatial locality than we did before. And we still have good spatial locality in overall, even though this and this are not next to each other, at least the things we access in consecutive iterations of the still small inner loop are next to each other. So our spatial locality is still pretty good for AKJ. And it's also still pretty good for Bij, because we're accessing Bij, Bij plus 1. There's next to each other, and we're accessing close in time because this inner loop is pretty small. It's not n big, it's 2. So if we actually run this, we get a substantial improvement in the miss rate. So we get about half the cache miss rate. So it actually does help. So we did that transformation by splitting up the K loop and then moving one of the things we split it up into. We can also do that for I. And it's going to help further. We're going to have more cases where we're accessing the same thing over and over again. We're getting more locality out of it. And we're not really hurting much the locality we had before because we're still accessing them frequently, because the innermost loop here, this is only doing 4 things. It's not, so things that we put into cache during one execution of these loops should still be around during the next one. So you're going to ask, why did I use 2? Why 2? Can we go higher? And the answer is, yeah, we can. And we get more benefit. Instead of having 2 uses of Bij, if we expanded the kk plus equals 10, we'd have 10. So in addition to doing this for both I and k, we can do it with larger numbers. So the general form this takes is that we're going to increment by some big K, big I, and big J. So sizes that we're splitting up our K's, I's, and J's into. And in this innermost loop, we're going to work on a big block of each of the inputs we have. And for example, for a particular Bij, there are k things we're going to use it for, big K, in the innermost loop. So we're getting a lot more reuse out of this. And similarly, for Aik, we're using it, we load it here, and we use it lots and lots of times, get lots more reuse out of it than we were before. And similarly for AKJ. So we're loading a whole bunch of things, we're keeping them in cache during this innermost loop, and by doing that, we try to use them as much as possible while we have them in cache. So we have these blocks of our matrices in cache, and we do all the calculations we can on them. So the catch here is that we want this block of A to be in cache for here, and the block of A and B to be in cache. We want all this stuff to stay in cache during this innermost loop. In order for that to happen, the cache needs to be small, needs to be big enough to fit it. So we're going to need to choose our big I or big K and big J so that fits in cache. And this is going to be generally how you get good performance, is by trying to use this sort of technique to get the most use out of the cache. That's what I have for today. Next week is review.